my colleague and friend Al Friedberg. Al, good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad you like to do this like every other quarter.
I do. I always look forward to a conversation with you. I always find it a treasure. Today is the third of May, and our format is going to be the same as it is every quarter. We're going to try and speak for about 40 minutes and let everybody get back to work. I'm going to ask Al some general questions, be the kind of interlocutor, and then I'm going to invite questions from investors and prospective investors, attendees to the conference call. We have a number of questions that have been emailed to us. If you have any questions that you'd like to have answered during the call, we'll try and get to them. Please email them to me directly. My email address is drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. That's drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. Okay, Al, let's begin. It was a brutal quarter. You went into the quarter with a very bearish bias, a bias that you described in your, I think it was third quarter of 2011 report as a anticipating a depression. You kind of seized that a bit and spoke about a severe recession at the end of the fourth quarter, and yet we were caught off guard by some of the maneuverings of central banks, which we did not anticipate. I think that let me start with something that you've written from in your quarterly report. You say that the Bank of England, or you quote Lombard, a 19th century economist, saying that instead of making outright purchases of sovereign debt, what central banks did was very creative, but it hit a great deal of deception. And while everybody applauded, as you say, the move, it really sets the tone for another run on banks. And then you quote Lombard, the adage exhorting the central bank to lend freely during a financial crisis had been turned on its head. Instead of lending at prohibitive rates against impregnable capital and thus cushioning the inevitable collateral damage and domino effect of a liquidity crisis, the ECB had lent freely at concessionary rates and concessionary terms against assets of doubtful value to solve a solvency crisis. Could you elaborate on that and try and explain to us not only what it means, but how it related to your thinking during the first quarter?
All right. What Lombard had in mind was that in a situation where there is a liquidity crisis, that there were many borrowers, potential borrowers, that had good balance sheets and had good assets on their books, and that they were affected by the general economic situation, financial situation. There was a run on banks. People were lining up to take their deposits out, their cash out of the banks. And so there were, since banks are based on fractional reserves, they were under threat, so that they may not have been able to meet necessarily all their liquidity needs in a very short period of time. So what Lombard said, look, central banks should offer those solvent institutions liquidity by discounting or lending against good assets, AAA assets, at penalty rates, so that you don't encourage them to do this kind of thing. You just save them from a very difficult situation, but you don't encourage them to do this type of thing. And so somebody may have, let's say, a bond, let's say at the time it was a bank, an obligation of the UK. It would go to the central bank, and central bank would say, okay, I can lend you, I don't know, 50 cents against the dollar that you're giving me in collateral, and I'll lend it to you at, 300 basis points above the bank rate. And so that's a penalty rate. That's a difficult rate. That's a hard rate. But that's money, cash, that the borrowing institution could have on hand to alleviate its immediate problem. This would take care of the crisis in the sense that the solvent institutions would survive, and the insolvent institutions who didn't have any good asset would fail. And this was something that was understood in the olden days in the early days of central banking, that you had to weed the system out of the bad players, and the way to do that is a liquidity crisis would do that, and the way it was done the central bank would help the process by simply allowing the solvent ones to remain in business. In our case, in the ECB case, this was turned on its head because the ECB said, "We're going to lend you money at almost free, 1% for 3 years, which is clearly a subsidized rate. These banks, the majority of banks in Europe, would not be able to borrow at less than 3%, 4%, 5% a year, maybe 6% a year." For 3 years, certainly for 3 years, and maybe more. So the central bank was giving them free money instead of a penalty rate, was giving them money against questionable assets. The questionable assets are government bonds that were already under suspicion, Italy, Spain. And in fact, the central bank was encouraging to buy these bonds and bringing them in as collateral, right? I mean, it's not that they had them in the books. The central bank was saying, here, we'll lend you some money, give us some of those bonds, buy some of those bonds. And the biggest buyers of Spanish and Italian bonds in the last 3 months were the Spanish and Italian banks, who borrowed money at concessionary rates on the central bank and bought these bonds. And, of course, they're trying to make the carry, what's called the carry. They're trying to make maybe 300 to 500 points of profit. It's a huge profit if it works. And so the central bank was not only allowing these people to stay in business, but was making it possible for them to stay in business, and at the same time was providing backdoor financing for these governments that were doing really little in the way of real reform. Now, that was to us a shock because I know that a lot of people were counting on the ECB to do something. A lot of people were counting on the ECB to pull a Fed move, quantitative ease. But a lot of other people thought, and we were among them, that the European Central Bank, modeled along the lines of the Bundesbank, would remain firm and would not do this kind of things. It would be sort of the last bastion of financial strength in the world and financial integrity in the world, and would not do this type of thing, would not engage in this type of operations. And when they did, it first of all had an electrifying effect on markets because we were very, very close to a liquidity crisis and to the failure of many banks, especially European banks. So they saved the day. Let's put it this way. They postponed the day of reckoning, and turned the markets around. And turned the markets around in a spectacular way. Financial stocks soared right after that. That took some thinking as to what to do. What does it mean? You can always say, well, these things don't last very long, and in the long run, we'll see again that insolvent banks will become even more insolvent. For example, now many Spanish and Italian banks are holding these securities that they bought recently at a loss. I mean, rates have gone up since then, so they're holding some securities at a loss. Now, will they mark to mark them? Will they not mark to mark them? Will they be forced to mark to mark them? At some point, unless Spain and Italy do the right things, those bonds will suffer some type of an impairment, and then these banks will all go bankrupt. So you know, you can always take the attitude that, you know, eventually things will work out anyway. But in the nature of our business, you can't do that easily. You can't wait these events. You don't have the luxury to take such a long view of markets. You know, you're highly leveraged or fairly highly leveraged, and if market moves against you 2, 3, 4, 5 percentage points, that represents a lot of money, because it gets multiplied, it gets magnified by the leverage that you have. So we had to start doing some things to take some protection, and it was a painful realization, and it was something that we had to do. And of course, it also, and that refers to the first thing that you said in the first part of that long question. It also showed us that, and it should always be there, the idea that economics and financial markets don't necessarily move it together. You can have a depression in your hand, but if there is a lot of money, if there's a lot of liquidity being pushed on the system, if rates are low, very, very low, you can have a perverse effect where you can have markets going up while the economy is going down. And the fact that that's what happened. Europe continues to go down into depression. When I say Europe, I mean most of Europe, not Germany. But the rest of Europe continues to sink into some kind of a depression. And yet markets are not reflecting that. And that is because there's a lot of ease in the system, there's a lot of money in the system, and there is more than that. There's a sugar daddy that's behind this, and the market knows that should anything untoward begin to happen again, once again the ECB, once again the Fed, once again the Bank of England will do something about it.
So we have moral hazard now, in effect, stamped on
writ large,
the DNA of markets.
Yeah.
So would it be fair to say, or to summarize this by saying that you made a political misjudgment? You misjudged the politics of the ECB, or the politics that surrounded the ECB, and once they surprised us, you adjusted the portfolio painfully, but you adjusted the portfolio and moved it from a very bearishly biased portfolio into an acceptance of the world as it is. And so that in the last quarter of, or the last month of the quarter, and now in the first month of this new quarter, we've really moved the portfolio into what I think of as a type of asset long short fund. And the results are quite pleasant.
Right. I mean, it was a political mistake. I don't think that we had any doubts that the U.S. would do that, and we didn't have any doubts that England would do that. I think that we thought that the ECB, because it was modeled on the Bundesbank, would never do that. However, it's not only that what they did, it's how they did it. And I think that it was very clever. It may be more problematic in the long run, but in the short run, it was extremely clever because it killed two birds in one shot. It actually helped the banks and helped the markets. In that sense, it was far more clever than the Fed quantitative easing move, which, you know, it buys securities in the market, it injects cash into the system, but the cash can be stuck, and it doesn't do very much for anybody.
We're
so
speaking about LTRO.
The LTRO. It's not just that they did what they did for $1.3 trillion worth, but that they did it the way they did it, right? And so that forced us to adjust a little bit, our positions.
Can you speak a little bit about what you've done, about how the changes that you've made?
Well, we had started doing that already earlier, actually. When we had a more bearish view of the world, we were more heavily committed to the short side of the equity market, and by way of markets that we still short today. We were short India, we were short Brazil, we were short Australia, a little bit of Spain. We were short markets that we're still short today, and we didn't change that. What we had begun to do, and which we did it with a lot more force now, was increasing our U.S. Long side. And it once represented a small percentage, and it now has become a much larger percentage. And so I would say that in some way, we are long U.S. and now long, and of course long Ireland through the Bank of Ireland, and now long a little bit of Germany too, by the way, in the last few days, against short still the same players, the same markets, India and Brazil and Spain and in Australia. So
you forgot to mention housing stocks.
No, that's U.S. You know, we're long the U.S. market. And in the U.S. market, we're long sectors like the housing market. So that's really the main change. The main change was to rebalance the portfolio towards a more neutral position on a global basis, on a global basis. We left the short market, we left the short position the way they were. A couple of them were actually cut back. We cut back some positions in European banks, kept others. But the main change was actually increasing the long side of the U.S. market. That was the main change. And now it puts us in a much more neutral position. And the idea here is, I mean, it's not a fully hedged portfolio in the sense that if it's perfectly hedged and fully hedged, you would never make any money, the market going up or down. But it is a market that bets on differentials. And here we are betting that the U.S. and Germany, for example, and Ireland would do better than some of the other ones.
I see. Okay. Before we get into, before we start to talk about, to get a little bit more specific, let's just leave Europe by giving a forecast of what the ultimate effects, the post-trading effects, the effects beyond our trading horizon might turn out to be. And by that I mean, like, what do you think ultimately is going to happen there? What is the clever though it is. Is the provision of liquidity going to generate yet another asset bubble and an explosion even larger than the one that we saw in 2008 and this year, or last year rather?
It's a complicated thing because, okay, the short answer, yes. The short answer is I think that it will create further imbalances. It is already creating enormous amounts of wrong decisions around the world. People are buying credits, and therefore the credit is being allocated in a very poor fashion because yields are so unnaturally low, people are chasing yields. And so they are getting into high yields without due respect for the risk involved. And so we are misallocating assets on a gigantic scale. People are buying junk bonds again, and they're buying anything that shows a return of more than 3 or 4%. People are buying without really thinking about what the risk involved is. This is one of the effects of a very low rate policy. Especially one that's unnaturally low because it's certainly lower than the rate of inflation because it forces people into it raises the animal spirits, like they used to say. It forces people, though, into buying things that they shouldn't be buying. So from the point of view of the economy, what it does to the world economy, what it does to the global economy, yes, it definitely creates major imbalances. And those major imbalances will be reflected in lower rates of growth or sometimes in other big busts like the one that we had in 08. So that's one effect of that monetary policy that we are seeing around the world, not just the ECB and the Fed, but also the Bank of England and also the Bank of Japan. The second effect, and probably the one that will bring it to an end, finally, is what it will do to the rate of inflation. Right now, we don't have an acceleration in the rate of inflation. We have inflation, but it's not accelerating. It hasn't begun to accelerate. Chances are that it will take a little longer still, but it will happen. And as the rate of inflation accelerates, it will begin to force central banks to take a more neutral position and eventually move off the zero interest rate policy, the ZIRP. I'm assuming that that will happen that way. Against that is the fact that there seems to be now the idea that the world or central banks and in collusion with Treasury, with the fiscal side of the ledger, are in collusion in putting on. Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry. I just heard a noise and I thought that didn't work. I in some form of collusion to keep rates negative for long periods of time, in order to dilute debt. Right. So if you keep interest rates negative, then the debt to GDP ratio begins to drop on its own, without much effort to cut back spending. Some of that took place in the 50s after the war when debt was very high and the U.S., for example, kept interest rates lower than the rate of inflation. There was the Fed-Treasury Accord, the famous Fed-Treasury Accord, and the rates were kept very low and inflation was higher, and so the debt-to-GDP ratio was diluted during that period. That wasn't the only thing that was happening then, of course. There was a lot of growth during the 50s, and that helped also. But in this case, there is the risk that we are in a collusion, that we are witnessing some kind of collusion between central banks and governments who are unable to borrow money at favorable rates and who want to borrow money at negative rates. You can see, for example, Spain and Italy can borrow money for 3 months and 6 months at 1%, 1.5%, 2%, very, very cheap rates. Almost all of these governments are borrowing money at shorter maturities because it's cheaper to borrow than at longer maturities. And so the profile of their debt is narrowing, is shortening. And but they are borrowing money at negative rates. So there may be an attempt. I made the assumption before that as inflation begins to accelerate, central banks will move off their zero interest rate policy. It may not be so. It may be that financial repression will be the game that they will play in the next stage, in the next phase, and they will keep rates at zero or pretty close to zero, in an attempt to cheapen and to dilute debt to GDP and to cheapen cost to the fiscal side. It may happen. We'll see.
Are you expressing a little reluctance to make a second bet on administrative policy, or is this a more?
Yeah, I don't know because this is something that these things are evolving. Just like quantitative measures, central banking quantitative measures evolved because this was not something that was in the horizon at all 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe 7 years ago, starting from the year 2000. We have evolved central banking into what it is today. The consequences will not be seen for some time, but they will happen. This type of thing also is evolving, and it may be that central banks will deem it more advisable to keep interest rates down even as inflation spikes. One interesting example, the UK, which is supposed to run a monetary policy that targets inflation, has missed its target for years, literally years. Inflation has been above their expectation now for, 3, 4, 5, 6 years. I can't remember exactly the time. And they keep making excuses. They keep saying, well, you know, we are inflation is coming down, it will be coming down, and they show you very fancy charts. Their annual reports and quarterly reports get thicker all the time with more charts and more tables. But the fact is that they are missing it. And if they're missing it either because they want to miss it or because they don't know what to do. In my opinion, they want to miss it because they want to try to help growth, misguidedly try to help growth, and this is what's happening. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether the next phase of central banking will see us go into that type of thinking. Financial repression is important. It's more important to keep debt to GDP ratio on a falling curve than it is to take care of inflation. It could be.
If we have negative interest rates, these have...
Not if. We have negative interest rates.
Let me rephrase. Having negative interest rates, as we do, has large implications for gold, for tips, and for equities. You are long gold, you're long tips, but you're both long and short equities. Can you explain how negative rates, how you're thinking about negative rates from a investment perspective?
Right. Well, that precisely what we've been saying. You got it right. Gold would benefit tremendously from negative rates, and as long as negative rates are negative, gold will continue to go higher. And I think all of this now, it's a pause. The market is just pausing, consolidating a very large gain. 11 years of rising price has done something to supply and demand, and I think the market is pausing now. The next move will be another very large upside move, and it will be driven by negative rates. Tips is the same. I mean, you go out more than 10 years, you can go out close to 20 years, and you see negative rates. We are still long bonds due in 2040, I believe.
I hope you're going to the gym and observing the diet.
But they still show positive rates, maybe 75 basis points, 75
okay.
basis points. And we expect those rates to go negative too. So, yes, we are making, interestingly enough, we are making a bet that rates will remain negative for quite a long time. We're not saying necessarily that the Fed will not raise rates. They may, but when they do, they will be forced to do that, and when inflation is substantially higher. So even if they raise rates by a quarter or half a point, they will be still behind the curve, which means rates will continue to be negative.
And what about as it applies to equities?
Equities is more complicated. It should do well, and I think that, for instance, the U.S. market can do relatively well. It is extremely bullish for housing. Affordability indices show that housing is at very, very cheap levels today. It's only a matter of time before we clean up the overhang. And we have a very big position on the housing stocks. We think that they're going to continue to do very well. And so negative rates are fabulous for housing. Not always good for everything else, because it does stimulate a lot of production in the capital side and create a lot of overcapacity. So we may be in a situation where we're creating a lot of overcapacity in many industries. You know, cheap rates, using the Austrian model, cheap rates would have a major impact on the capital goods sector. So it's not always positive for equities. But at any rate, the U.S. Is in that phase, and therefore we should be able to take advantage of that. Other countries, as an example, India has had to raise rates. Their rates are, I still think that they're probably a little bit negative, but at a much higher level than ours. And so that's not favorable yet for them. And so you cannot make a bullish case. And it's the same thing in Brazil. In Brazil, actually, rates are positive. That means rates higher than the measure rate of inflation.
Your ambivalence about equities is reflected in a sudden spurt in dispersion in U.S. equities and the equity hedge pocket of the Global Macro Fund, which earlier in the first quarter suffered, is now starting to blossom.
Right, right. There's a lot more dispersion. There's a lot more dispersion because the markets have become less binary. I think that's maybe the reason. In this environment where there's a central bank behind you, there's a central bank making sure that you don't fail, and there's a central bank providing very cheap liquidity, risk on risk and off risk are a little bit blurred. And I think that you can get certain sectors to do much better than others. And probably that's the reason why our equity hedge portfolio has done extremely well in the last 30, 40 days.
The equity hedge portfolio has a normal allocation. The equity hedge pocket has a normal allocation in the Global Macro Fund. The currency pocket has shrunk. Is this
right
because you have a view that the U.S. dollar is trapped in a range, or can you elaborate a little bit about why you're so little committed to trading foreign exchange?
Because most of what we see in the foreign exchange market is pretty much a reflection of the global picture that we already that we already have in the rest of the portfolio. We can yet find individual plays that are not related to the main themes. And so if we were in currencies today, we would probably be replicating the rest of the portfolio, which doesn't do us any good.
I see. Okay, thank you. Let's speak a little bit about individual names. You've got a lot of investors interested in gold mining stocks because of your history in smaller developing miners. NEM and GG have collapsed along with a lot of lot of mining companies. Can you speak about this?
Yeah, last year we liquidated gold bullion positions and gold futures positions. And for example, for the asset allocation fund, we replaced some of it partially with gold mining shares because we thought they were very cheap. In fact, they got cheaper. And in the last few weeks, we got out of those and replaced it back with gold. The problem with gold mining companies is that they are beginning, because we have now a well-developed market in gold itself. We have ETFs, a tradable instrument that institutions can buy. They have lost a lot of interest in gold mining shares. There was a time before the ETFs that gold mining shares was the only way that institutions could participate in the gold market. Once you got the ETF and once the volume started coming in and liquidity came in, there was no question that institutions would prefer that. It has less management risk. It has less event risk. It has less financing risk. It makes very little sense to buy mining shares for institutions if what they want to do is play the gold market. So there's been a downward revision of multiples. At one time, gold mining shares were trading 40, 50 times earnings or more. They've come down. And at least for producers, we're starting to get P ratios of anywhere between 10 and 15, which is a lot more normal. It's a lot closer to what, for instance, copper producers or aluminum players get. And that downward revaluation, continues even today. So that's in the producing area. the non-producers are finding a lot of problem in getting financing, and they need a lot of financing for their projects, billions of dollars. It's easier to find it practically than to develop it, and so that too is affecting them to a great extent. So if you want to be in gold, you're better off. It's simpler to be in gold itself than being in mining shares. Mining shares are attractive for those who can buy them at cheap enough prices and can put them into production. Otherwise, it's better to buy gold.
I'm going to ask you. We've got time, I think, for one more question here, and I'm going to ask it selfishly. Not a month goes by that I don't get people calling me, asking me, is Al still bullish on the Bank of Ireland? Can you please tell me what Al's views are on the Bank of Ireland? Does Al still hold the Bank of Ireland? If you could rescue me from some of these calls, I'd be very grateful.
No, I don't want to rescue you from those calls. You know, if I rescue you, then you'd be calling me all the time. So it's good for you to be on the phone with them. But really, I have nothing new to say on the Bank of Ireland. I think it's basically the old story. It's going to be a long-term story. It's a bank that went through a cataclysmic event, but cleaned its portfolio and recapitalized itself and services the Irish economy and part of the Irish economy, some of it in the UK too. They have a lot of mortgages in the UK. But I think that they're in a good position to take advantage of their unique, it's a unique position that they're in Ireland, a very well-known bank, very solid, very, very solid ratios, capital ratios. And I think it's not a story from quarter to quarter. I think it's a long-term story. You buy it and you just hold on to it and you wait. Almost like a Buffett story. You know, this is a good bank, that has the potential, if it does the things well, has the potential to be one of the best banks in Europe.
Good. Okay, I think that we might be 92 seconds earlier than we have been in the past, and so it gives us 92 seconds more work to do. Al, thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on what I think was, from my own perspective, a very trying and very difficult period that I watched you negotiate, I think, really well, and wish you good luck along with all the other investors on the coming quarter.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.